When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming, episode 172. I'm your host, Will Evans, and tonight I'm heading all the way down to Devon, my favourite part of England, to talk to farmer Gillian Dixon. Gillian, how are you?
I'm very well, a little soggy, but yeah, doing very well. Thank you very much.
Yes, it wouldn't be a farming podcast without some weather chat. Feels like it's been raining sideways for a month here in North Wales. How's it been down there?
Pretty much the same, I think. Yeah, we were getting a bit short of grass and wondering what we were going to do. And then once it started raining, it just doesn't seem to have wanted to stop.
No. Well, I've been outside in the rain all day today, so I'd much rather be here chatting to you. So I have an advert to read out. I'm very disappointed that my dad joke about it didn't get more of a reaction last week. So I'm going to say it again. With this advert, I'm really spoiling you. Ambassador is the joint highest yielding variety on the recommended list, offering growers increased security in suboptimal nitrogen conditions. Ambassador possesses N-Flex, the latest trait to come from Lima Grain's market-leading oilseed rape breeding program. It's a fully loaded hybrid, combining N-Flex with Turnip Yellows Virus, Pod Shatter, and RLM7 Foamer Resistance. What more would you want from an oilseed rape variety? And you can learn more at lgseeds.co.uk. Gillian, South Yeo Farm. I couldn't think of a more Devon-sounding farm name if I tried. What's the origin of the farm? That's Yeo, Y-E-O, by the way, not Yeo like you would hear in an 80s rap song.
No, and sadly not linked with Yeo Valley yogurt or anything like that either. But no, there are a lot of Yeos around this area, and Yeo is an old Saxon word for water, of which we suffer from plenty. So we have about a kilometre of river through the farm, and we are south of the water.
Yeah, okay. Because Devon, I sort of know it reasonably well, and there's a lot of kind of interesting place names. Barton is another one, isn't there? A lot of Bartons in Devon. It seems to have a bit of a distinct, I don't know, a lot of distinct place names. It's very interesting, I think.
Yeah. I think, well, most areas in the country must have theirs. I grew up in Kent originally, and there were lots of Dens, Smarden or Biddenden, so D-E-N on the end of words as well. So.
Sure. Yeah, okay. So describe the area. Tell us a bit about that part of Devon.
We're about 20 minutes north of Dartmoor. It's very green. We're on clay soils. So it's completely a pasture farm with a bit of woodland. We don't do any arable. We did dabble a few years ago, but made a horrible mess. So we decided not to do that. So we just stick with the grass here. Go sort of 15 minutes away from us and you're into red soils, which, you know, lovely arable ground, but we're just grass where we are.
Would it be mostly mixed farms, livestock, bit of dairy in that area?
Yeah, we do still have a few dairy farms around us, and a lot of beef and sheep in the area too.
Okay. And it's your husband Ian's family farm, is that right?
Yeah, his grandfather bought the farm in the 50s. Okay. His dad farmed it initially as dairy. It was quite run down, so he tells stories of having dairy cows tied up in all the barns, wherever the accountant told him to get cows, so he sort of shoved them in every corner he could. But then in the 70s he kind of switched to beef and sheep, and then he retired in the mid-90s, and the farm was let out to a local dairy farmer then, actually, who used it for his dry cows.
Right. Okay. So, are you from a farming background as well?
I'm not. I grew up on a small holding in Kent. We had poultry. The local farmer used to put his sheep on our field, and then cut it for hay in the summer. I used to spend a lot of time talking to the sheep, feeding them hay through the or yeah. grass the fence. So I always was keen on animals. But I met my husband when I used to work for the West Country Rivers Trust as a farm advisor.
Okay.
So we had a project in the area, and the tenants at the farm, because he wasn't farming then, were kind of running the stock through the river and out the other side. There was no fencing. So the river was eroding really badly. So we sort of joked that it was so bad I had to move in to sort it out. Delighted. I've been telling him what to do ever since.
Oh, that's brilliant. So when did you decide to take the farm back and farm together? I guess that must have been quite a big decision.
Yeah, well, we met in 2000, I think it was, and like I said, it was all let out at that point. I was working, going around visiting other farms and advising on how to manage the ground without impacting on the river. Mm-hmm. And it just seemed really hypocritical to be doing that and not be able to practice it ourselves. So we started to take back a field at a time. As our stock numbers grew, we sort of gradually took back a field each year until we had the whole farm back in hand. And it sort of became obvious that I couldn't carry on full-time work and do that. So I gave up my job to start running the farm business, and then as it went on, it became obvious that we needed Ian full time as well. Couldn't be in two places at once. So
no,
grown from small beginnings.
So did you have at that time, and we're going to sort of discuss your sort of farming and environmental ethos shortly, but did you have a particular way at that time that you wanted to farm? Did you have a set idea of the way you wanted to do it, or did that just sort of develop over time?
I think we realized that so the farm's 93 acres with and of that there's about 10 or 12 acres of wood, so there's only 80 acres of grass, and we realized that on a small acreage like that we couldn't farm, you know, traditional commercially,
yeah.
and take stuff off to market, get the price that's, you know, on the day, and be able to afford to live here and just do farming. So we decided that we'd go down the route of focusing on native or traditional breeds and market everything ourselves. So, and that grew out of my interest. I love coloured sheep particularly. So we sort of chose coloured breeds and try and use everything. So we have the wool spun into balls to sell, or we sell the fleeces to craft people and spinners. We do meat boxes direct from the farm, so we get the skins back made into rugs and sell them as well. So we try and maximize the value from every animal to make it 80 acres more commercially viable.
Yeah, and that I guess you were, I was going to say you're ahead of your time, because a lot more people are sort of looking to do that now, but I suppose 20 years ago, was that, did sort of people, I don't know, did you get any naysayers? Did anyone say, well, that's not going to work or not?
I think probably a lot of the local farmers sort of looked at us with our funny coloured sheep and and funny shaped sheep, you know, woolly headed things that, you know, they weren't sort of your typical white commercial breeds and sort of sniggered, but, you know, we're still here, still doing it. And seemingly, you know, going from strength to strength. We took on some ground from a neighbour a few years ago. Some ground came up for rent. As my husband said, he lived here his whole life, and ground immediately next door had never come available. So we'd be silly not to take it.
Yeah, of course.
Hadn't planned on looking for it. So we actually now run about 150 something acres. So it has grown a bit in that time.
Fantastic. So on your website, and I do encourage everyone to go and have a look at some farmerdixon.co.uk, it says, and I really like this, it says, at Southio Farm we believe in doing things the traditional way, with small fields, old vintage tractors, breeds that are just a little bit different, and farming in tune with nature. We're passionate about rare breeds and always put the needs of our animals first. And I don't know, that sounds like everything a farm should be, I guess, to me. Is that something that you, I don't know, is that do other people say that to you, or
I think we got involved with the Devon Association of Smallholders, so we'd quite often do farm walks and training courses and things for smallholders. So I think we have almost a smallholder ethos,
yeah,
but over a bigger area. I think it's the way we would like to be, but I think a lot of farmers, we just get so busy and on that roller coaster trying to do more and more that you kind of forget, and it is difficult.
I'm nodding yes very much in agreement. So I know you mentioned it, but perhaps give us a bit of an overview of exactly what you do on the farm and the many different enterprises that you have there.
Well, it's sort of changed over the years as things have developed. So, I mean, if you had said to me 20 years ago you're going to be running a farm, I would have sniggered into my glass of wine. but it has changed as things have grown. We initially started off doing a lot of poultry because that fit in while I was still working. I was able to manage that. So we had over 30 different breeds of poultry.
Wow.
All in different breed pens, and we'd sell hatching eggs and young birds rather than just selling eggs at the gate, because we get about 3 cars a day go past, so that wouldn't work. And we used to mail out hatching eggs all around the country. So that meant we could obviously reach people further afield. That has now become very popular. There's a lot of people doing that, but hugely time consuming. It used to take couple of hours just to feed and water everything, and then if you factor in sort of cleaning out houses, etc. Ian did say to me at one point, "Do you remember me? I'm your husband. I live here too." Fair enough. But anyway, that allowed us to sort of build up.
Yep.
And when we first got the cattle, we went off to see someone on Dartmoor, chose a couple of cows, and said, "Well, we can't afford them just at the minute. We need to sell some more eggs and chicken." And he sort of had a little snigger. But 6 weeks later, sort of went back. It was a bit Jack and the Beanstalk. Went back and bought some cattle.
Yeah.
So we've never taken out any loans. Everything that we do, we try to fund from the farm. So gradually sort of build up that way.
Yeah.
So now we've got the cattle, and the sheep came along fairly quickly too. The poultry has reduced because more of my time is spent doing sheep and things like that.
Yeah. Okay. So tell us about the different breeds of animals that you have.
Different breeds. So sheep-wise, we started off with a small Welsh breed called Balwyn, which are black with a white blaze, feet and tail. They look a bit like Zwartballs. People quite often see them and think they're Zwartballs, but they're a native breed. They are quite small, but they're extremely hardy. We barely have to help them lambing, etc. We built up to about 50 of those and were doing meat boxes, because if we took them to market, 20 quid or if you're lucky, sort of thing. But the meat is superb, and of all the breeds that we've got, they're the one that we would choose to eat ourselves.
Is that right?
So we had sort of 50 or so of those, and rather than just get more and more, we decided to get another breed. So we got some Shropshires, because they very good for grazing amongst trees, and we planted an orchard and some conifer Christmas tree plots, so use them for sort of natural weeding and run them through the trees. They don't bark the trees and kill the trees.
They're the only ones who don't, aren't they? Is that right?
Well, seemingly we've and then the sheep addiction sort of kicked in, and I also have other breeds, but we had a pile of logs from some tree work that we were doing in a field, and my Rylands just put them in the field, and they went straight to the logs and stripped the logs of all the bark. So I wouldn't dare let them into somewhere where the trees weren't protected. Coloured Rylands. I'm running down the list now. Got some black Bouffes Leicesters, although I'm finding that they're just a bit too delicate really for our farm.
Okay.
Because we took on the rented ground next door, realised that if we wanted to continue doing meat boxes, we'd have to have a huge customer base to fill all the sheep that we had. So we thought, well, perhaps we'll do something a little bit more commercial alongside that we do have the potential to take to market. So rather than get white sheep, I got some blue Texels.
Oh yeah.
So we've got some pedigree blue Texels as well. So they all run together, but we put the purebred rams in with them at tupping time.
Do you lamb outdoors?
Used to, but we have a real problem with crows and foxes, and the Balwyn lambs are so small that I worry about them just getting picked up.
Mm-hmm.
So we tend to lamb inside. We lamb in two lots, so the Texels, Rylands and Shropshires we lamb in January. they're quite a heavy sheep, and our ground is very wet in the winter, so it actually serves two purposes. It gets them off the field and inside, sure. To protect the ground. So they lamb then, and then the rest of them we lamb in April. So on nice days, we let those ones out during the day, but back inside at night.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Wow. I didn't realize you had quite so many different breeds. So what about the cattle?
we've cut down. No. So we've only got a small herd now. We have beef shorthorn.
Okay.
We have had Rigget Galloways as well, which are quite an interesting breed, but we decided just to make life a bit simpler, because we don't generally run a bull, that we just stick with the shorthorns.
Okay. So is it just sheep and cattle, or have you got goats or anything else?
We used to breed pigs, but again, our clay ground just doesn't suit keeping, you know, adult pigs outside. So we tend to buy in a few weaners a year and rear them on for our own freezer, and then just to keep the customers happy that have sort of got used to having various pig products from us. And I do have goats.
Yeah.
Husband, I'd say long suffering, but I really like goats, and I was badgering him for years to, you know, to let me get some goats, and he said some fairly rude words and eventually relented. And I knew he wouldn't drink goat milk or eat goat meat. So in trying to find a breed, I sort of went for something that was neither of those, and we went for pygmy goats, which are not your average farmer's goat, but they're great time wasters. They're hilarious, and there's actually a really good market for them. So we sell the wethers as well as the females for more than you could sell a sheep for. So so actually, Ian was being persuaded the other day that perhaps we should get more goats.
Goats seem to have had a bit of a renaissance, don't they? They seem I don't know. Just seem to be hearing more about them, seeing more about them, and
I think so. Yeah.
Interesting.
Definitely popular with smallholders. It's one of the first breeds that they animals that they will get.
Mm. For sure. So, when you first got the livestock, did you always plan to sell direct to the customer? Was that something you always wanted to do from the start?
I think so, because the breeds that we chose aren't mainstream. Mm-hmm. We found that they appeal more to smallholders rather than commercial farms. So it made sense to sell direct rather than go through the market. So that's why initially I set up the website to try and reach the smallholding market. But obviously since then, I sound like an old person now. So that newfangled social media has come along. so that is very useful for helping to reach customers as well.
I'm sure. And what kind of reaction do you get from, say, I don't know, from a first time customer, the first time they've ordered a lamb box from you? What's the kind of typical reaction you get?
Because we're talking with the customer, a lot of our customers, or as many as possible, are local.
Mm-hmm.
So we invite them to come and to see the animals, to see the farm, to see how we're doing things. We do courier some out, and so people that we haven't met, but generally are very very excited by getting it. They'll get pictures back of the meals that they've made. Quite often they will then sort of come back, and they might start with half a lamb and then realize that actually they enjoy it so much that they then go for a full lamb, and then go down the sort of beef and pork route as well, which is nice. I remember when we first did our first bullet privately, we were just a little bit anxious about how we were going to sell all this meat that comes back at once.
Mm-hmm.
We've got a big commercial fridge, so when it comes back from the butcher, it goes straight in the fridge. And we sort of looked at this wall of meat, but within 24 hours, it was all gone. And I think everyone knows what to do with beef, with every bit of beef, you know, mince and steaks and joints. Whereas, you know, scrag end of lamb, they sort of look a bit questioningly and wonder what to do. So, it's been very popular, and I'm pleased to be able to cut out the middleman and to sell it directly, where we can talk to people about what we do and why we do it.
Yeah. And do you think that customers just, I suppose, enjoy that interaction with a farmer, you know, that relationship. They want to get to know their local farmers. That's something I'm seeing more of, I think.
I think so. And I think, I mean, obviously it's not going to be for everybody, but yeah, it's, we've had people that have bought our meat and then come down on holiday and come and visited, which I think is really nice.
Cool.
Some of our first customers, you know, have been buying meat from us for sort of 10 or 15 years. And that we find that once someone discovers you, they tend to then stick with you, which is nice. Even if, you know, obviously there's farms nearer them that they could link up with, because they've got the relationship, they stick with it, which is really, really nice and very, very gratifying.
Yeah. And I guess, yeah. And I suppose that customers will, you know, you only have to look on your website, and again, you know, I do urge listeners to have a look. You know, people probably just enjoy the whole ethos and the way you farm as well. You know, that's something that we're all increasingly conscious of, isn't it? You know, trying to reduce food miles or buy more ethically. So I suppose that's something that I guess is equally important to people. Is that something you find?
Yes, absolutely. I think people like to know that the animals are being reared perhaps more slowly, because the breeds that we've chosen don't finish quickly. So quite often we'll be selling hogget rather than lamb, particularly for the bell in the smaller breeds. So the fact that they've gone through a winter. Our pastures haven't been reseeded. Ian's father would have reseeded them, obviously, when he was doing dairy, but we've not. We try to encourage clover in the pasture. We've got one lovely field down by the river that we always cut for hay, and we cut it late each year to allow the wildflowers to set seed. And when we put the sheep on there, we notice that they always come off a lot, I won't say cleaner, but you know how sheep can get. So there's natural plants in there, which gives them the sort of variety of herbage, which is, you know, they're eating a selection of grasses and plants.
Fantastic. So, I mean, direct selling is something that a lot of farmers are really sort of dipping their toe into that now. And as you say, it can be a bit daunting when you just give the example of the beef there. You know, it can be, if you've never done it before, it can be a nervous thing. I mean, we just started doing it. My daughters have 50 hens and they've been busy selling eggs to all their friends, parents and their teachers and things. But it's been really nice to just get that reaction, and I've really valued it. You know, if farmers are listening and they're sort of thinking about starting doing a bit of direct sales, what advice would you give to them as someone who's been doing it for a while?
Well, I think initially we started selling to family and friends, which are your, you know, obvious sort of first contacts to try with. I think it's all about telling a story. So rather than just constantly badgering people and saying, we do this, buy this, it's, you've got to I won't say reel them in, that's, but, you know, to try and pick out what the main selling points are. Yeah. What is it about you that's different to everybody else? Why people should buy from you, but don't sort of beat them around the head and say, you must support British farmers. Which obviously everyone needs to do, but it's you know, it's picking what you do well and being natural and coming across naturally. Don't sort of try and put on a front, I think.
Yeah. Okay. The environment is clearly something that's very important to you both. What kind of things are you doing there on the farm to farm with nature?
We've done all sorts of things. When I first met Ian, his father, who had done a lot of drainage work around the farm, I think thought that I was going to turn the farm back into a nature reserve and didn't really like me for a while. But he's sort of come round to what we're doing. So hedges, for example, we don't trim the hedges every year. We do a map for our head. It's one of the few things we don't do ourselves. We have someone, a friend, come in and cut the hedges. So we pick certain hedges for him to leave each year. We let some grow up and we lay them. We've sort of picked out hedgerow trees to allow to grow up as well. We put in ponds. when I first met Ian, I was very river focused. So we did a lot of works along the river. We fenced off the whole sort of kilometer of river to stop the livestock from getting in. Which we've seen a real change in the river since doing that. It's really really fascinating to see, because when I studied rivers when I was at university, when I did my master's, I was focusing on sort of watercourses and things. So it's been like a giant field lab. It's been fantastic. But we've got otter. We see otter down there.
Wow.
Well, I've seen them once, but we've seen evidence of.
Oh, brilliant.
And the fact that there's an animal at the top of the food chain sort of indicates that everything down below must be in sort of fairly good heart, which is lovely. So we sort of leave field margins. We deliberately cut late to allow wildflowers to set seed and things like that around the farm.
That's fantastic. And when you've fenced off the river, you've planted riparian strips with willow. Is that right?
One of the first fields that we took back from the tenant the river was eroding so badly that it was actually pinching off a bit of field to the point that we couldn't physically get to it with a tractor anymore. So we decided to plant it up to willow. This was before we had any livestock. And we would harvest the willow and sell it as sort of long whips for garden structures or as cuttings to other people to grow biomass willow, etc. But with my sort of rivers hat on, we did a bit of what they call river revetment work. So that's using living willow woven at the edge of the river to help protect the bank.
Okay.
So where the force of the water was eroding the bank and undercutting it, so we put living stakes into the water along the foot of the bank, wove cut willow in between the stakes, which obviously is that bit is dead, but the stakes that went in would take root. Because it's not a concrete structure or something sort of man-made, it allows the water to get through the willow weave, as it were. So you still get invertebrates and fish in behind the willow structure.
Okay.
But the willow will then sprout and grow up and protect the bank. And in some places it worked, in some it didn't. But there's still bits of willow there from that we planted 20 years ago that are sort of holding the bank. And it definitely, we were losing meters of riverbank a year. And it definitely slowed it down.
Yeah, I think it's a problem for a lot of us who farm by the river now, isn't it? It's certainly something we're having issues with, and we're actually planting a lot more willow along the rivers now. There is a lot of willow along the riverbanks here anyway, but in places where there isn't now, we're planting more there, and it's definitely helping already, I think.
Definitely.
And I think I've been quite surprised that there's been a few strips that we have fenced off, and very, very quickly the willow just started growing itself. We've planted some, but it just started regenerating itself.
Yeah.
And I was amazed how quickly that happened, actually.
When I first met Ian, I said that livestock had access to the river. So the first thing we did was fence it off to stop that. The river was very wide and shallow because there was no vegetation to hold the banks together. So we used to get a lot of filamentous algae growing in the water. And because it was shallow, the water was quite warm, so it couldn't hold much oxygen. So it was not so good for fish life, etc. But just simply by fencing off the river, it meant that the grasses and things that were able to grow up within the space between the fence and the top of the bank. Will trap any sediment whenever it floods. So quite quickly, that whole area started to vegetate over, and the height of the ground built up. So 20 years later, the river is now running deep and narrow rather than sort of wide and shallow.
Right.
So you've got nice cool pools to fish to live in. I know we were talking before we came on air about the kingfisher. We often see kingfisher down there, and we had a chap from English Nature came along and did some surveying one year, and he had a camera on the end of a stick. Well, I guess something probably more technical than a stick. And he would put the kingfisher nest in a burrow in the vertical bank, and he would stick his probe in and sort of monitor how they were doing, so he could see the eggs, cool. And then see the young. And he got some amazing photographs of the kingfisher down there. It's fascinating.
That's amazing. We, my wife and I forget when it was now, probably it must have been last summer. We just happened to go for a walk along the river one evening. It was a lovely sunny evening. And we sat on the riverbank. It's one of the rare, I think my mum must have, I don't know, I can't remember why we didn't have the children with us, but it was a rare occasion when we didn't. And it was lovely and peaceful. We were making the most of it. And we just sat by the river, and a kingfisher just out of nowhere just came and glided along the water right in front of us. And it was just, they're just so majestic, aren't they?
They are, just that flash of blue as they zip past.
Yeah, that incredible shade of blue. So yeah, I got very excited when you said about your kingfishers. Yeah, tell me a bit more about those hay fields and the wildflowers that you get there. I'm really interested in that because it's quite an old concept. So in Wales, on a lot of farms years ago, they would have a cae ysbyty, as we would call it in Wales, a hospital field. And they would have a lot of sort of different herbs and flowers and mixed species grazing, I suppose, in there, as we would call it now. I mean, it's nothing new under the sun, I guess. But tell me more about that. Really interesting.
Well, it sort of happened initially a bit by accident, I suppose. The first two small fields that we took back from the tenant were the two riverside fields. So it was before we had any animals of our own. And it was foot and mouth year in 2001. So the tenant's animals all went off the farm.
Okay.
So this field grew for the first time in years. And in the grass, I spotted an orchid. And so I said to Ian, you know, can we cut that late? Can we let it set seed before we cut it? So I sort of went and stuck a cane in next to it so we knew where it was and whatnot. So we cut it late in August for hay. So we started off just doing small bales of hay and selling that. So the next year, again, we cut it and we cut it late. And I think it was 9 orchids the following year. And then the year after that, there was close to 100. And then after that, I couldn't count. There were just so many. It was just lovely, just purely by a change in management to allow the wildflowers to set seed. So we always cut that field late now. Yellow rattle appeared out of nowhere, obviously in the seed bed somewhere, hadn't been able to sort of grow and flower previously. So once the yellow rattle got into the pasture, it's parasitic on grass, so it reduces the amount of grass in the pasture, which then allows the other wildflowers to come through because the grass outcompetes them. And we don't spread dung on the fields, so wildflowers like low nutrient situations, so that field doesn't get spread. We do graze sheep in it after we've taken the hay off, and then perhaps just for a week or two in the winter time. But I always make sure that they're off by the end of February, just to allow the wildflowers as they start to grow to not get nipped off by the sheep. And it's been fascinating to watch the spread of the flowers through the field. So there's one end which is definitely better than the other. The poorer end is the end that tends to get flooded more. So I guess there's nutrients coming in the sediment, which gets deposited when the river floods. So it's not so good for the wildflowers in that end. But also we've noticed a sort of a boom and bust cycle as well, that because the yellow rattle is parasitic on grass, gradually the amount of grass in the field decreases. And so it's like any parasite, it's sort of got rid of its host. So then the yellow rattle declines, the grass comes back. So at the moment we're in a sort of a period where there's more grass there than before, so there's not quite so many wildflowers. But I'm hopeful that will switch again. Ian being ever the farmer, so, you know, we can't turn the whole farm into wildflower meadow, so fair enough, we do actually need some grass for the animals in the winter. So we focused on this particular field, but we had a meeting with a friend of mine who works for gonna have to edit that one in. I think it's Flora Locale.
Okay.
And we were talking with him about increasing the wildflower meadow on the farm. So there's another 5-acre field that generally gets cut for hay, but just when the weather's right, we cut it. It's not necessarily one that we leave late. So I think this year we're going to let it go later, to disc over an area just to break up the soil a little bit. And I'm going to collect some of the rattle seed from the riverside field and spread it up there and try and encourage more wildflowers in that field as well. So.
Fab. It must be lovely walking through on a summer's evening, I guess.
It's beautiful, except I discovered I have hay fever.
Oh, did you?
so you can always tell when I've gone for a walk in the hay meadow because I sort of come back all snotty and sneezing.
Yeah.
Not ideal.
No, I have a bit of hay fever as well. It's amazing how many farmers do, actually. You'd think we'd all be immune to it, wouldn't you? But me and my dad do. But anyway, training courses. You have a lot of training courses there. You have people on the farm and train them in various aspects of agriculture. How did that start?
How did I come back? Well, it started. I got involved with the Devon Association of Smallholders in 2006, pre Facebook, which has killed things off. So through my involvement with them and the fact that we tend to sell our stock to smallholders, we found that we were getting asked the same questions when people come to pick up their animals. If they've not had them before, you know, how do you do this? What do I do for that? So we'll do a day. You can come and choose your lambs, for example, and then we'll work with them and we'll talk through, you know, how to look after them and what to look out for, etc. And so it gradually grew from there. The Devon Smallholders have a training program where they offer various courses on aspects of smallholding to smallholders or anybody that wants to come along. So initially we started doing the courses for them, but we also now run them privately as well. So we tend to do a day focusing on a particular species. So we do sheep, pigs, poultry, cattle days. We've done a land management day where it's an excuse for my husband to get all his tractors and bits of kit out and look at land management. Typically it's for smallholders, it's not for sort of bigger farmers. So it's looking at, you know, why you use a topper, when you use a topper and harrows and that sort of thing. What the options are, not that they necessarily go out and buy all the kit themselves, but then so they know what's available so that they can get a contractor in. We used to do some more environmentally courses. So I used to do a river management course. So we would look at how to farm with a watercourse going through. So look at different types of fencing and we build otter halts and things like that. But we found, particularly after 2008, with the sort of financial crash, when things were a bit tighter, that the nice to do courses weren't so popular. People were more focused on the animal husbandry ones.
Okay. So I guess the teaching aspect of it must be very fulfilling. I guess is that something you'd done before, any teaching or educational with your previous job or?
So when I was at university doing my master's, I used to have part of the agreement with my tutor was that I had to help run some of the laboratory courses, so it helped with that. And then through my work with the West Country Rivers Trust, we quite often did talks to groups of farmers, which I found terribly daunting at the time. I wish I'd done this the other way around, done farming before I did the advisory work, but you know. But so I was reasonably comfortable talking in front of groups of people, but I'm particularly passionate about sheep. So I mean, the poor people that come on our sheep courses, I'm practically chasing them down the drive as they're trying to leave, because I keep bombarding them with information. But I really enjoy it. I really help getting people started, and it's really rewarding when we have people that have been on the courses that then get back in touch afterwards and let us know how they're getting on with their animals. Some courses people sort of click more than others. So there's one particular group that quite often we have people that come from quite a distance around the country and they'll stay locally, but this particular group were all pretty local, so they were able to get in touch and keep up with each other afterwards, and 5-6 years later we're all still sort of quite good friends. Some of our best friends now are probably people that have been on our courses initially. It's sort of become a bit of a running joke. How do you know Gillian? I bought sheep from her and then it goes from there.
That's fantastic, though. So what kind of, I don't know, do you get any people who have zero experience, like complete beginners? Do you?
Yeah, quite often. And it's been really noticeable. We've been doing courses now for 15 years, how it has changed. So it started off being people that wanted to get a different animal that on the small holding, but there's so many people, I think, moving to the countryside, wanting a little slice of the good life, buying a few acres, and not knowing where to begin. So quite often I'll have a room of people. We sort of go around the room, do introductions at the beginning, and quite often none of them will have had any sheep, for example. So it's all completely new.
Yeah. So how do you, I don't know, if you get a complete beginner like that, how do you, I suppose what I want to ask is how do you teach them without, because sometimes it's difficult as a farmer. I'm not phrasing this very well. You have a lot of accumulated knowledge. You've grown up around animals and you might not consider yourself an expert, but you kind of know this stuff. It's second nature. So I'm quite interested to know how you teach that to someone who's a complete beginner without patronizing them, because that's a skill in itself, isn't it? Sometimes as a farmer, we do that by accident.
Yet there's a whole new vocabulary that people have to learn, that hogs are not pigs, they're actually it's particularly difficult when you've got people in the room who have no experience, and then someone that's had sheep for 5 years but thought they'd come and brush up. So it's difficult to pitch it.
Yes.
There was one particular person who I've become very good friends with since, who kept referring to lambs as babies. So when they have their babies, and we're all sort of piling in, no, they're not babies. you just have to take it back to the beginning, I think. You soon get to realize if you're pitching it too high from the questions you're getting.
Yes. I suppose you have to just adapt a bit to every different individual and group, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But it must be a lovely thing, I guess, what different courses do you offer then? I know there's quite a big array. I did look on the website, but there's you do a lot of different things.
Yes. I think perhaps we need to rationalize. the core ones are the sheep, pigs and poultry. We do a sort of a beginner sheep, which really is starting from scratch. We start off with the regulations, because that's quite daunting for someone coming in that hasn't had any experience of that. And the fact that you don't get any, there's no one government organization to go to. There's lots of different departments you have to deal with. So we sort of try and go through all that, and that kind of breaks the ice. And then from there we go on to, let's actually go and look at some animals and the rest of the day. So with the sheep, we also do a sort of a more advanced sheep course. So once people have perhaps learnt the basics, got the sheep, then come back a year later and do slightly more in-depth stuff. We do lambing courses in the spring. We tend to do the lambing courses in January with our early flock, recognising that probably the majority of people lambing for the first time will be lambing in March or April. So it means that they can do that first, get a bit of hands-on, and then go and take it to their flock.
Mm-hmm. Mm, fantastic. Mm. Yeah. Okay. Farming with the environment the way you do, and we've heard a lot about the different things you do and your whole ethos so on the farm. We're in a big period of change with UK agriculture at the moment, and a lot of trade deals being struck and moving to a UK agricultural policy. Do you worry about things like that, about trade deals and that the effect on British farming and the environment and the way a lot of us are trying to farm our land? Or is that something you don't focus on and you just concentrate on what you do best?
I think it's difficult to answer that, really. I do worry about it hugely. I think because the way that we're doing things on our farm and we are direct marketing, it perhaps doesn't affect us quite so much. We're not we're not subject to sort of market price fluctuations quite so much. But the way things are going with the change in the BPS is obviously going to affect things. So that is a concern, in that we feel we're doing a lot of those things already.
Mm-hmm.
And if it becomes a reward-based system, it's kind of favouring people that are trashing the place, paying them to not do it,
yeah,
as opposed to those that are trying to farm sensitively.
Mm. Yeah. So what could the government do? We're all, I guess, to an extent, waiting to see about the new environmental schemes. And we've had environmental schemes on farms in this country for a long time with very mixed results. Different schemes have worked and different schemes haven't. What would you like to see from the new schemes, do you think?
Eek. It's very difficult because, I mean, we were an entry level stewardship, and when that changed to mid tier, we just found it too complicated, and we just decided just to leave it. We're doing a lot of it off our own back.
Mm-hmm.
I think the new schemes need to be simple to get engagement. I think it has all become very, the application process has become quite complicated and daunting, and I think that's probably putting people off, and the people that you need to engage with are probably just going to brush it off and not take it up.
Mm. As we've talked about, you are very busy. You have a lot going on the farm, and it's grown a lot over the last 20 years. Where do you see the future of the farm? What's next? What would you like to do next, do you think?
I think my husband would like me to focus a bit more. Perhaps not have quite so many different sheep. So I think it's trying to focus on what we do best and pare it down to that. So try and do fewer but higher value animals, perhaps focus on the pedigree side of things. So some breeds I've started off with non-pedigree animals just because I really like them.
Mm-hmm.
Quite like them, gone down the pedigree route, and we've got into showing now, which I just absolutely love. So I think focusing in a little bit more. That's always a difficult question because we sort of bumble along from year to year, and things sort of grow without plan. We sort of, you know, fallen into some things.
It's unfair of me to ask that question, really, because I don't like being asked that question either. I did a thing not long ago where it was one of those things where they ask you where do you want to be in 5 years, where do you want to be in 10 years, and all that kind of thing, and I just found it so hard to answer. I don't think in that way, but maybe that's wrong. I don't know, but I guess we're all different. But anyway, okay, hard-hitting questions if you're ready. What's your all-time favourite song?
I've always liked Bryan Adams since I was young teenager. So I think it's probably Everything I Do by Bryan Adams that was in the charts for months and months.
Absolute
back
classic.
In the 90s, I guess it was.
Yeah, it must have been early 90s. Yeah, classic. Absolutely brilliant. Okay, if you could time travel for 24 hours, where and when would you go?
I think probably in an ordinary year, I'd want to go to some tropical beach and just chill out. But the last year or two, I have family in Canada. Okay. We were hoping to get over there last year to visit, so that the yearning to go and see them is quite strong. So I think I'd really like to get over there when it's safe to do so.
If you're having a bad day, and we all have them, especially this year, what do you do to make yourself feel better?
We've got three dogs,
okay,
which are supposed to be working dogs, but it's a very small W. they have wheedled their way into the house. If I'm having a bad day, take them down to the river and chuck a stick about so they can go and have a swim and just sort of sit on the bank and realise that actually it's not all that bad.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You've got a big two big bookshelves behind you. I can see shelves full of books. So what's the best book you've ever read?
Or maybe
the book that's had the most impact on you.
Impact. Okay. So my father, unbeknownst to him, bought me for my birthday a few years ago, John Lewis Stemple's Meadowland.
Okay.
I hadn't heard of him then. And I think, you know, father was, because he lives in another country, it's difficult to buy gifts overseas. So he had ordered this and it was sent to me, and it was just beautiful. It was John's description of his farm over the course of a year. And it, that really had an impact on me, I think. So I've subsequently read several of his others. And then more recently, James Rebank's English Pastoral, I think, has had a big hit. Have you read that one yet?
I have read it and his first one, which had a very big impact on me. But I read them both, and I'm a big fan of John Lewis Stemple as well. I really like The Running Hare. Particular favourite of mine. Lastly then, what's your favourite agriculture related social media account to follow and why?
I guess that changes over the years. I started tweeting because a friend's children said, "Oh, you've got to do social media for the farm, otherwise no one's going to know about you." So I started following the Farmers of the UK account, which I found is really useful to learn about different types of farming, much like your sort of little podcast. And on Facebook, there's a group called Ladies That Lamb. So I'm guessing you probably haven't seen that one.
I haven't been in the group, but
I've
heard of it.
But it's a really useful group, very supportive. I quite enjoy being part of that one.
Fantastic. Okay, Gillian, it's been fantastic to speak to you. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Thanks for asking.
I'll get on the website and put an order in for some lamb. I'll get on with that tonight.
Thank you very much.
And urge everyone listening to do that once again. Okay, to everyone out there, thanks for listening, and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans. This has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you, and good night.